Item one, all good things come to an end. Item two, that's okay. Item three, not everything that's called good actually is, especially in economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Tuesday, the 2nd of May. Good to have you here, everybody. It is a truth universally acknowledged that the good times cannot go on forever. Exhibit A today, the American automobile industry. This morning, major car makers pretty much across the board reported lower sales last month as compared to a year ago. And that is for the fourth straight month, by the way. Ford, GM, Fiat Chrysler, Toyota, all of them. But the thing is, not all bad news is all bad. Marketplace's Jed Kim gets us going.
Sales of new autos have grown steadily for the past 7 years. Now it appears that streak is coming to an end. Cars aren't moving off the dealership lots like they have been, but analysts aren't worried. Christian Gichek is with the Center for Automotive Research.
This, you know, seven-year expansion is the longest expansion we've had in the auto industry since 1917. So it really was, you know, quite unprecedented to have that much of a run-up over that many years. So, you know, we're kind of flattening out a little bit.
And plateauing when sales are high is not so bad. Part of the reason for the slowdown could actually be an improving economy. The Fed has raised interest rates, and that means higher interest on car loans, too, says Jessica Caldwell. She's a senior analyst at Edmunds.com. Caldwell says the average loan rate for new cars breached 5% in March and April.
That hasn't happened consecutively since 2010. So I think some of the interest rate effects are starting to manifest in auto loans. And that, of course, would also pump the brakes a little bit on new car sales.
To get rid of excess vehicles, car makers are likely going to scale back production and make it a buyer's market. You could hear more of those ads for zero down, 0% plus cash back. Jeff Schuster is with LMC Automotive.
This isn't a bad time to buy a vehicle because the deals are going to be there. As the competitive pressure takes over, that's likely to drive an incentive increase.
Mostly for sedans, because that's what's sitting around. Americans are still buying plenty of SUVs and crossover vehicles, so fewer deals there. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
About interest rates, by the way, which Jed mentioned, the Fed is meeting today and tomorrow on that topic. Not a whole lot of betting that they're going to raise them this time, but then again, one never knows, does one? The current mantra with President Trump seems to be look at what he does, not what he says. That said, however, words like facts matter, especially those of the president of the United States, which gets us to his Twitter feed this morning, in which he said, as perhaps you've heard already, that what America needs is a, quote, good shutdown, in air quotes, in September to fix mess. The mess being, it's clear from the context, the difficulty the White House is having getting its agenda through Congress. This afternoon, Budget Director Mick Mulvaney took a question about what a good shutdown might be. Here's that tape.
But you asked me what a good one would look like, and a good one would be something that fixes Washington, D.C. permanently. Yes, sir.
Reasonable people can disagree about the definition of good, I suppose, but one thing is completely clear. Government shutdowns are not good for the economy in straight dollar terms or in intangibles. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Shutdowns happen when politicians can't agree on government spending. Usually someone thinks we are spending too much.
The irony, of course, is that the government shutdown ends up costing money.
Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. In a shutdown, hundreds of thousands of federal workers are sent home to do nothing.
And the reason that that ends up costing us money is a lot of things don't get done during that shutdown, but we often go back and pay, for instance, the salaries of the government workers who are furloughed during that time period.
This costs government workers, by the way. If they get paid late. And while they're waiting on their money, research shows they're more likely to miss rent, mortgage, or credit card payments. Matthew Shapiro, professor of economics at the University of Michigan, did some of that research, and he says government contractors have it even worse.
They get laid off. Unlike the government workers, they're often not reimbursed.
Beyond unemployment, government shutdowns have consequences for the broader economy. When parks like the Grand Canyon shut down, tourists can't go.
Businesses like hotels and restaurants and shops that thrive on tourists that visit our national parks, they will suffer too.
Beth Ann Bovino is chief economist at S&P Global Ratings.
Think about all the businesses that need a permit to start a project. That also has to be delayed.
Take one small industry like crab fishing. The last shutdown in 2013 delayed the start of the Alaskan crab season by several days, costing fishermen thousands in lost revenue. The Office of Management and Budget said that shutdown also delayed lending to small businesses. Standard & Poor's estimates that two-week shutdown cost the U.S. economy $24 billion. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
True story, I got shut down two times while I was a federal employee, got back pay both of those times. We are not. Moving on now, a nation of savers, not even close. The average household has basically no retirement savings. That's according to the National Institute on Retirement. And those that do, and it's not a big group, most of them have work-related savings plans like 401ks. There are individual retirement accounts as well, created decades ago to let everyone save. But the Wall Street Journal reports today on a study from the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College that says IRAs aren't serving the people they were most intended to help. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has more.
Thinking about retirement often happens because your employer is thinking about it for you. Teresa Gallarducci is an economics professor at the New School for Social Research.
Only half of American workers even have a retirement account, mostly because half of Americans work for employers that don't offer one.
And a big chunk of the nearly $8 trillion sitting in individual retirement accounts was rolled over from employer-sponsored plans. So why aren't more workers without employer plans taking advantage of IRAs? Olivia Mitchell heads up the Pension Research Council at Wharton. She says one reason, they don't have money to save.
The other is that Social Security will pay you a relatively high benefit once you hit retirement. So the need to save more may actually be reduced for low-wage workers.
IRAs also tend to have high fees, which can erode tax benefits, especially for small contributions. Again, Gallarducci.
In fact, a low-income person might do better by just putting the money under the mattress.
And for a lot of people, an IRA isn't even on the radar. Or they need a push, says David Ray, a certified financial planner in Los Angeles.
It's very rarely going to be, oh, I'm going to, you know, start saving for retirement. You know, when I first came out of college and I didn't even have a job, someone sat me down and made me put in $25 a month into a Roth IRA. So,
in a way, that's what states are trying to do. Five have passed new laws to automatically enroll workers into accounts, and more than a dozen have explored the idea. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
A little bumpy on Wall Street today. Whole lot of nothing by the close. Folks were waiting, as traders do, on Fed meeting weeks to find out what Janet Yellen was thinking. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The list of ways the Trump administration has shaken up official Washington is long. But up high on that list, no matter who's making it, have to be the various changes of heart at the Environmental Protection Agency. Former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, who in his prior life sued the agency more than a dozen times over its regulations, is in charge now. He has sided with the chemical industry on pesticides and oil and gas industries on climate change. But this is not the first time the regulatory pendulum has swung so profoundly pro-industry. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong looks back.
In 1978, heavy rains fell on the Southern California city of Glen Avon. They overflowed a nearby toxic waste site, longtime corporate dumping ground, and sent a chemical foam into Glen Avon. That's where Penny Newman's kids were playing. She still remembers.
They were making beards out of this foam. They were becoming snowmen in toxic foam, and nobody told us what was going on.
The industrial sludge contained arsenic, DDT, cyanide.
Their tennis shoes were falling apart, their Levi's disintegrating. My youngest son was having blurred vision. He'd come home from school talking about how the tetherball poles were stacked on top of each other, having this double vision.
Newman would become an environmental activist, just as Congress discovered hundreds of toxic waste sites around the country and passed a bill to clean it up. The Superfund law collected money from taxpayers and from polluting companies. But weeks after it passed, America got a new president who was a friend to some of those companies, the anti-regulatory Ronald Reagan.
Regulations of every kind on shopkeepers, farmers, and major industries add $100 billion or more to the cost of the goods and services we buy.
Reagan brought a hostility to the government that shook up the Capitol. Republican David Durenberger was a senator from Minnesota at the time.
It was clear as soon as he took office that he was not as sensitive to the work the EPA did.
The EPA was a young agency then, just a decade into its existence and growing, as it enforced new laws on clean air, clean water, and waste. But in 1981, conservative ideologue Ann Gorsuch was tapped to run the EPA, the first woman in that job. Her teenage son was Neil Gorsuch, now Supreme Court Justice. Gorsuch had a record of criticizing the agency and its bureaucrats. Jonathan Lash is president of Hampshire College, and his book on the Gorsuch EPA is called A Season of Spoils.
It seemed like she came in with a deep suspicion of them and of their motivations. The nickname she got from the staff was the Ice Queen.
Gorsuch saw her agency budget cut by a quarter. Enforcement cases by investigators plummeted.
There were explicit communications saying that every enforcement case you bring will be a black mark against you.
Cleanup of that toxic waste site in Southern California, the one that spilled into Glen Avon, well, it was inexplicably delayed. Why? Well, an EPA whistleblower leaked documents suggesting it was politics to undermine the Superfund regulation, to protect polluting companies, and to deny an environmental win to California's governor, a Democrat running for the Senate.
And caring about the people who are drinking poison water didn't factor into the equation.
That's the whistleblower, Hugh Kaufman.
That's where I became sort of a very low-level figure in the scandal.
A scandal that blew up. Congress accused EPA head Ann Gorsuch of botching Superfund cleanup. It held her in contempt, and she quit in disgrace after 2 years. Her deputy, Rita Lavelle, went to jail for lying to Congress. Meantime, the agency, well, it tried to retaliate against Kaufman, sending investigators to follow him.
And they found that I was in a hotel with a strange woman, and so they thought they had me until they found out that the strange woman was my wife.
Nothing came of it.
They thought they could squeeze me by checking out my sex life, but I was even an old man then, wasting their time.
In fact, Kaufman is still at the agency. After Gorsuch quit in 1983, the agency's original administrator from 1970 returned to restore some order. He had bipartisan support. But longtime EPA regulator Mike Cook says the scandal damaged morale at the agency. He's now retired and recalls that many once idealistic colleagues, they either quit or they became jaded clock watchers.
People working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, suddenly they were working 40-hour weeks. And we went from a couple of softball teams to 9 softball teams.
To him, the agency never recovered.
That imposed a level of cynicism about outside political interests, and that has just never gone away.
It's the cost, he says, of an administration openly hostile to the EPA's underlying mission. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We're going to go up to Anchorage, Alaska, for about the next minute and a half or so for the latest installment of our series, My Economy, where you send us your economic reality. We put it on the radio. Today's dispatch is from Clark Yerington, who, after more than 30 years working for architecture firms, has recently decided to go it alone.
I'm sort of late to the game here, being a little older in my first foray into being an independent business person. A firm that I worked for more recently, they came into the office every day and they didn't have any work. And, they ate their top ramen for lunch and talked amongst themselves and sort of feebly cast about and tried to find more work, but there really wasn't any for anybody. It's kind of tough, you know. I won't lie about that. It's not the easiest thing I've ever tried to do, but the upside is really incredible. I'm really glad to be out of the office. This one house that I'm working on now is possibly the most beautiful home site I've ever seen in my life. It's just a wonderful spot on that hillside. up above Anchorage with a little rise on the other side and a creek running through the property and these big spruce trees, and it's just fantastic. I'm kind of struggling day to day, but I'm by no means ready to give up on this. More likely, I'm going to double down and try as hard as I can to make it successful.
Clark Yerrington up in Anchorage, Alaska. Take a second, would you, and share your story with us? They're always really interesting. There's a place you can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
There are these people who kind of slide into your social media feed. They look like your friends, but they look kind of better.
Yeah, kinda. Hashtag reality check. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 36 points today, about a 10% finished at 20,949. NASDAQ up 3 points, basically flat, 6,095. The S&P 500, 2 points to the good, about a 10%, 2391. Airline executives appeared before a congressional committee where they were told to improve customer service or else. Investors liked the sound of that. United Continental soared 5.2%. Alaska Air climbed 2.4%. Advanced Micro Devices announced a $73 million quarterly loss yesterday. Paid the price today. Chipmaker shares off a quarter of their value, a full 25%. Rival Intel made bank on that. Shares up 1.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.28%. We'll see where that is tomorrow after Ms. Yellen speaks. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hospital stays can be traumatic. They just can. But not all hospital stays are created equal. The National Institutes of Health says 30% of patients who wind up in intensive care go through a period of profound confusion that's known as ICU delirium. That delirium can lead to longer stays, which leads to higher costs, which explains why Parkland Hospital, down in Dallas, Texas, as part of a national project to prevent it. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports.
It would have been easier to leave 56-year-old Mary Hill in her hospital bed. She's got a bunch of tubes and lines attached to her. She just had 2 emergency stomach surgeries after going into septic shock, and she can't move her legs.
Good job, Miss Grab
this.
Nope, not yet. Don't turn yet.
Kara Tabor, the physical therapist in the surgical intensive care unit at Parkland, is gently supporting Hill as Hill uses her arms to lift her legs one at a time and pull them toward the edge of the bed.
Sorry, keep Anna, coming. This is not pretty.
Well, it's not meant to be pretty because you're doing all the work.
Okay.
Hill is doing all the work for a reason. Like every patient in this ICU and 76 others across the country, Hill is on a treatment plan designed to prevent ICU delirium, an intense period of disorientation and confusion that can develop as a result of being hospitalized. It can bring on paranoia, hallucinations, and serious long-term side effects. Here's trauma surgeon Brian Williams.
She's a perfect example of a patient that we probably would have hurt a couple years ago.
Not intentionally hurt. Hurt by giving too many sedatives, by allowing her to lie in bed all day with the blinds closed. That's been standard ICU protocol since the 90s. Now Hill has a team of doctors, nurses, physical therapists, pharmacists, all closely monitoring her medication, cutting back on sedatives as soon as possible, and constantly getting her moving.
You can see 2 weeks after being septic and intubated, she's mobile and talking and dramatically different outcome that would have happened a few years ago.
ICU delirium affects people of all ages. It might sound minor, but it means more time in the ICU, where just one day can cost $10,000 and a higher chance of dying. By some estimates, delirium can add as much as 39% to a bill. After studying ICU delirium for the past 2 decades, critical care doctor Wes Ely with Vanderbilt University Medical Center designed the program Parkland and other hospitals are following. It's called ICU Liberation. And so far, it's been a success.
It dramatically reduces the amount of exposure that patients get to these dangerous drugs. It gets them out of the bed sooner. It mobilizes them, plus involving the family so patients get reoriented. And it makes a massive difference overall to the patient.
A paper published in the journal Critical Care Medicine shows adopting the ICU Liberation program improves survival and reduces the amount of delirium and coma by 15%. That doesn't mean it's been easy.
Obviously, as we start getting them up, getting them unsedated and out and about, it's a lot more dangerous for them. We've got lines and tubes and all these things that could possibly go wrong.
Parkland nurse Kim Mai says there's been a cultural shift in the ICU to work in teams and manage new risks.
The old culture was keep them safe. Now the culture seems to me like get them better faster. And I was very, very happy to be a part of that.
For patient Mary Hill, one sign she's getting better, making it into her wheelchair.
Excellent.
Hill is out of breath, but encouraged.
You may not realize it right then, but the next day you can do something else.
Rolling over, sitting up, small movements that together will get her closer to home. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
We're going to do a little social media now, Instagram in particular, pictures, pretty ones of pretty people in pretty surroundings with a van in the shot. The hashtag in question is van life, and it is oh so much more, apparently, than people just grabbing a shot on a road trip going someplace. Rachel Monroe wrote about it for The New Yorker. Rachel, thanks for coming on.
Great to be here.
Tell me what van life is, first of all, would you?
Van life is a hashtag that spawned a movement that is increasingly popular on Instagram. And it's most basically people who live in vans and take pictures of themselves living in vans. But it also has come to stand in for this whole lifestyle that involves traveling, camping, outdoor yoga, and not having an office job.
And at least as told in your piece through these two folks, Emily King and Corey Smith, it is profitable, I guess. I mean, they make a living doing this, these two people do.
Sure. They are part of this trend towards influencer marketing where they get brands to sponsor some of their posts. So they'll take pictures of themselves with a bag of chips or a water bottle, one of their sponsors in the background, and have a hashtag, and they get paid for that as a kind of ad.
And the travels then essentially become a product.
Exactly. They are, I think of them as kind of this new wave of advertising that are sort of aspirational peers. So there are these people who kind of slide into your social media feed. They look like your friends, but they look kind of better and they have more interesting lives. It's difficult when you're trying to sell an image to advertisers. Only certain things are going to fit into that image, and it's going to be the most idealized, beautiful version of things, and not reality doesn't necessarily sell.
Yeah, it is also, you say, a phenomenon born out of the Great Recession.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was interested to learn that the couple that I traveled with had some significant student debt that they were dealing with. They graduated college in the middle of the recession and without a lot of prospects for kind of solid career jobs that would provide for them for the long term. And I think that's another story that doesn't always get told in the pictures. This lifestyle is appealing to people because it's cheap and because they don't have a lot of options for settling down and building a solid life. So they turn it into this kind of aestheticized version of freedom that looks really good online.
Could you do it?
Would I do it?
Could you? Yeah.
Well, I don't think I have enough Instagram followers to... I don't think my brand is strong enough. But no, it's a lot of work. It's so much more work than I would have even thought. I mean, they spend hours on every single post because they have to edit it. They have to negotiate with the sponsors what it's going to look like, what the caption is going to say. There's just so much work that goes into looking effortless.
Rachel Monroe, she's a contributor to The New Yorker. Her piece is called Van Life, the Bohemian Social Media Movement. Check it out. It's a fascinating piece. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, a new survey by Glassdoor, that's a jobs site, about internships in some top American companies and how much they pay, which is a lot. Topping the list, Facebook, where median intern pay is $96,000 American dollars a year. Two things about that. First of all, median means half of Facebook's interns make more than that, and yes, half make less. Also, the median family income in this country is about $54,000 a year. And we are out of here. The Dow up 36 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ basically flat. S&P 500 up 2 points, about a 10% there as well. Tommy Andres is the producer on our Special Projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.